bits and pieces. So.
Yeah, please share.
Okay, this I looked around and tried to, you know, there was lots of things I suppose I could have brought with me, but when I did my BA honours in fine art, I enjoyed the course in general. It was an amazing course. It was in Hereford, and but I started to really enjoy, and this was quite unusual for a fine art student, I started to really enjoy the written side of the course. A lot of people kind of really despised doing dissertations and essays. But, and as things went along, I started to really enjoy it, and especially as I could incorporate my personal kind of interests. And I wrote my final dissertation in the third year about the musical performers, the, I don't know if you've heard of the female male impersonators, which was kind of, they were a huge part, and I became a bit of a geek, you know, for the for this kind of stuff, the music hall and the Victorian kind of stuff. And I got this CD, and I suppose a lot of this links in as well. Do you remember that Tipping the Velvet and the adaptation and, on TV, as well as the book by Sarah Waters? And this was music that was kind of not on the programme, but it sort of inspired, you know, sort of... these are actual early recordings of some people like Vesta Tilley and sort of another performers. Ella Shields is another one. And it is pretty cool, actually, you know. You can find a lot of these things online as well, you know, but this is quite overtly kind of queer, you know, the way it's packaged and the agenda behind the selection of music as well, you know. So it kind of almost... And some of the song lyrics are quite amusing as well. They kind of... they've even got, like, a little booklet inside. And actually, it kind of links to Brighton in some way, because if you go to the Hove seafront, there are some sort of big old houses. There's an Italian restaurant that does ice cream and things like that, and nearby there's one of the old houses has a blue plaque, and it says that Vesta Tilley actually lived there at a certain point. So that's kind of quite a nice sort of connection. I think a lot of these people would have had connections with Brighton anyway, just for the nature of the place. And the first song on here is brilliant. It's one of my favourites of this kind, but you'd have to hear it in a way to get it. But it's called Masculine Women, Feminine Men. And the lyrics go, masculine women, feminine men. Who is the rooster? Who is the hen? It's hard to tell them apart today. And it kind of goes on and on about, you know, sort of... And that was from 1926, that was. So, you know, it sort of shows that there was always this kind of gender play and sort of... And kind of a camp sensibility as well as, you know. But interesting to find it. I mean, these are not all the male impersonators, actually. Some of them were sort of male performers that maybe had a camp sensibility, or some that performed in drag, I think, as well. There's someone who had a connection to Brighton, actually, if I can... Mm. So it was a really good play on at the Marlborough. It was part of the Pink Fringe, I think, or the Brighton Fringe. And I can't remember the name of the... but it's a Brighton-based author who's also done a kind of one-person play, where they sort of reference some of these performers. And Douglas Bing, it was the name, and he was apparently a very camp sort of entertainer.
You should really get involved with Queer in Brighton, because the event that I first went to of theirs, there's a local performer that dresses
maybe this is
in
the thing.
Drag and sings this song.
I think this is the thing. This is I went to see it, yeah. And it was brilliant, actually.
Yeah, she's...
Because it had the history, didn't it?
I'm not sure how that person identifies. Yes, but it was really quite lovely and refreshing.
Definitely, and kind of humorous, and reminds you as well that people were going, and that this is kind of the appeal of some of this. I mean, even if the performers themselves, who knows how they would have historically, you know, put it, given the historical context, how they would have identified. I know that with Vesta Tilley, at least in public, she identified as female. She was married. She was part of the establishment. Became a lady. Her husband was Lord something, and so she was hugely part of the establishment. But there certainly was this kind of undercurrent, you know, in especially and a class thing as well. There was a performer called Hetty King, whereas Lester Tilly would do the slightly more kind of maybe middle class chap about town and the young man about town. Hetty King was the sort of sailor and the kind of working class guy, and had all the mannerisms. And then you had a camp sort of performer like this Fred Barnes. And I think I was kind of obsessed with all these people at one point.
When you say camp, what do you mean?
I mean camp in the sense that he was actually inspired by Lester Tilly. Mm. And I would have said he was in the tradition. There seems to be a little bit of a tradition sort of the kind of matinee idol almost, you know, sort of in this country. Actually, there's he was a Welsh performer called, what was his name? Ivor Novello. Mm-hmm. And they named the Ivor Novello Awards after him. And he was a matinee idol, very, you know, he had a lot of female fans and very handsome man. But in his private life, he was a gay man. And it was the same with this. So there was that kind of sensibility came through, you know, so almost like a kind of matinee idol. So I mean camp, maybe not in an overt way, but he was inspired, I think, as well by Lester Tilly. Mm. So he kind of, there was kind of a lot of interest in gender kind of... he was almost doing an impersonation of a male impersonator, you know, in a strange kind of way. But the sound of it, obviously, I've never seen footage of him, but going by the descriptions. But and there was also this Douglas Bing, and there's not a picture of him in here, but it was part of this play. And I think he used to dress in drag, and the songs are overtly. If you listen to one of the songs, is for instance called "I'm a Bird," and his language and his style is very much in the British camp tradition. I'm thinking of, I'm trying to think of people to compare him to, but maybe that kind of Oscar Wilde, Quentin Crisp, but also the kind of drag performers as well, you know, that kind of sensibility. And there's another one he does on you as well. What's it called? Oh, I won't go into too much. I'm a Mummy, an Old Egyptian Queen. And he was quite overt, I think, in his kind of camp set, which is, I mean, there's always been a huge part, I think, of the British kind of entertainment world anyway, that's kind of always loved and been very comfortable with these types of performers. Mm. And this is why I thought the male impersonators were quite interesting, because even though we still find a lot of the drag queens and the very famous female impersonators even these days, and I remember growing up with some of these people on TV and things like that, the male impersonator disappeared. It wasn't a figure that you would see. I know we've got drag kings now, but this male impersonator was a mainstream sort of entertainer. And that seemed to disappear totally. You don't hear about people in a mainstream sense, say, you know, let's go, unless maybe pantomime, which a lot of these people, which is, again, very British, that idea of the principal boy and or the person dressing as Peter Pan and things like that. So, yeah, so this CD, basically, it kind of connects with this fascination I had and the dissertation and my own interest in very interested in this kind of quite dapper, kind of dandyish kind of quality, you know, that I guess these performers conveyed, and just find them.
And when did you sort of get involved in this as an interest?
It was quite a while ago, actually. Yeah. So it would be some years ago now.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know, eight to 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it was an ongoing sort of interest that kind of culminated in this dissertation, and but focusing particularly on, you know, the whole musical thing was of interest, but especially these performers that, you know, had a particular interest, and certainly some of these songs. And there's another one on here as well. Mm-hmm. I can find it. Burlington Bertie from Bow was actually performed by Ella Shields, who has a very androgynous voice. Mm-hmm. If you could listen to, mm-hmm. And you can actually see. There's a clip of Ella Shields performing that on YouTube, because she was one of the performers that was still doing their thing. A lot of these people kind of missed the boat when it came to film and things like that. They were more recorded artists. But there is a clip of on YouTube of this Burlington Bertie from Bow, and that became quite a... It's just quite an interesting song in itself, really, and... But there's also another cool one. I think Ella Shields would be my favourite, really, of these. I don't know what... she was actually an American. I'm saying she, I'm not exactly sure. Mm-hmm. She would have identified, mm-hmm. but was an American entertainer, mm-hmm. and who then established themselves in this country. But they were more candid, I think, in some of their songs. There was another, trying to find where it was, but there was another one. She sang one called Why Did I Kiss That Girl? And I think there was very much more of a candid knowingness, you know, and a sort of a suggestion of something queer, you know, sort of, which is quite interesting to find, you know, sort of at that point. You sort of, I don't know, maybe you're talking like 1900, something like that, you know, so maybe a little bit later. So, yeah, it's just a kind of interesting thing, and the music is definitely worth, if you've got any kind of interest. I quite like those types of old recordings anyway, you know.
Yeah.
It's quite cool, and the CD just brings them all together under a, you know, in quite a cool way. But so that was my little... And I got these in sort of, in a sense of a personal kind of sentimental photographs. Yeah. And, yes, these are my major inspirations, you know. I said before I never knew the grandparents from my father's side of the family, and I was brought up, my mother brought us up on her own. My parents were divorced. And I was lucky enough to have these amazing grandparents who were a big part of my early life. My grandfather actually passed away when I was going on 16. Mm. But my gran only actually, which was way back when, but my gran actually passed away just a few years ago, actually. Mm. She lived to be 96.
Wow.
And that was a photograph I captured of her. She loved cooking. And she would have been in her 90s in this picture. And she'd actually been in service, domestic service, and from quite a big family. And she had to go out to work at quite a young age. And she continued, though. She had this absolute love of the domestic, cooking, caretaking, nurturing, as well as being generally, you know, quite a big personality. She loved people and she loved to talk. She was very warm and was very curious and very interested. Even when I told her I was a vegan, she was trying to get her head around it, you know, and she was trying to think of things I could have, you know.
Mm.
And, so I would say she's... this was a morning, I remember, she was doing something like, trying to think what it was, a kind of, like a tart with a lemon curd tart or something like that. Or it might have been rhubarb, actually. It'd be a rhubarb tart. And I sneaked in and took all these photos, you know, sort of her doing what she did, I guess, in her element. And, and then there's my granddad, and he's massive and in the sense of, both him and my father, actually. I often think about the idea of masculinity, you know, and kind of where you learn these things. What does it mean to be masculine, to be a man? And where do you learn your ideas, you know, of what this kind of thing means? And for me, I suppose a formative idea of that would have been my grandfather. My father, and even though very different in so many ways, they were, I've realised over the last... maybe, I don't know, since I've been thinking about it, actually, that where they were quite similar, their presentation, they were always pretty, you know, quite smart, quite gentlemanly, you know, in many ways, even though from my granddad, anyway, my father, I guess, I'd say more of a middle-class background, my granddad more of a working-class background, and yet always very, say, very gentlemanly. And so that this was an early idea that I had about masculinity. You know, he loved music. He loved classical music. Passionate he was, actually, about his music. And he was always the kind of person that would write to the BBC about things. You know, if he was interested, he'd always write off and get information and stuff. So it's like a self-taught person. And, so they kind of, they mean a lot to me. Someone recently, when I went to Sweden, I asked them how they identified, because they'd asked me the same. And they said they found this really cool term that they related to, and it was power femme. And I remember thinking, that's so cool, you know. That. And I was thinking, my gran kind of was like an early version of that, you know, because she really was all those things. And she's given me a love, actually, because even though I connect very much with kind of a masculine side, unlike my mother, who was never into cooking, my gran kind of instilled in me this kind of love, you know, passion for the... And I don't see any kind of... don't know what the word is really. I don't see, I see they can work quite well together, you know, kind of a masculinity, but also that caretaking, nurturing, they don't seem like different things, you know, and or mutually exclusive. So, yeah, so they have massive influences, basically, so these were sentimental. I don't get the chance, really, to sort of to show their photos quite, you know, often to people outside of the family.
Great.
So they really, so this was John Field, my granddad was, and people knew him as Jack, and Dorothy was Dorothy Bevan, then Dorothy Field, and Dolly, they used to call her, so, and proper, wonderful pair, you know, so. And I was very lucky, actually. And, so that's kind of an element of the family, you know, the family history. And, this I was something I picked up in... I went to another intergender course, which was in somewhere called Utrecht. I think it's Utrecht, I can pronounce it. And it's near Amsterdam, little city, and in the Netherlands. And there's like a queer bookshop there, a really cool Savannah Bay, I think it was called. So if you get, you know, maybe you'll get a chance to go there, actually. I'd really like it. And they had all these cool things, and I managed to get this James Baldwin, sort of been looking back and sort of taking an interest, really, in his work. And I just thought it was quite a cool quote, you know, there is never a time in the future in which we will work out our salvation. The challenge is in the moment. The time is always now. And I just love, you know, sort of anything that kind of grabs me and, you know, sort of kind of quotes and things like that. And I just thought it was quite cool. I enjoy reading as well. So, and exploring his work, actually. And this has been a year of kind of discovering so many cool authors. Something I would have liked to have brought in, but it was too big to carry. But there's a picture that's been really important this year, as well as discovering the writer, actually, someone called C.L.R. James, who was, I'd not known anything about him before this. I should have done, actually. It just goes to show that, you know, you don't. But he was a Caribbean author that he'd written a lot about post-colonial sort of theory. He was a Marxist as well, a Marxist thinker. And he wrote many interesting things. But there's this one particular photograph. I'm often quite drawn to the human element, you know, and there's this black and white photograph of him, and it's really weird, but he reminds me of my gran, like a kind of West Indian version, a male version of my gran. And in this particular picture, he's got the white hair, you know, and the kind of... and that, so that would have been something that would have brought a very powerful picture, actually. And And hopefully he'll be someone I'll talk about within my work. And even with James Baldwin, he's written, I discovered when reading more about him, he'd written a children's story, a sort of book, which I knew nothing about. It was from the 1970s. And there's potential to maybe include that character. There's a character in the book called Blinky, I think. It has a tomboy kind of quality. It's quite a sort of deceptively simple kind of children's story with it's illustrated as well. But that to me is quite interesting. If there's a way to maybe incorporate that character and maybe reference, you know, some of those things. And yes, I brought this as well. I just thought there's a lot of films I could have brought, but it's David Bowie, The Man Who Fell to Earth. And yes, I like all kinds of films, but there's something about this film, you know. You can go back to it, watch it many times, and I suppose some of the themes in it as well, you know. And you can have a different perspective on it every time you come back, you know. As well as it's quite seductive as well, you know, the visual style of it, and David Bowie at that point, I think, in his career, and. I wouldn't say the heavy kind of stereotypical things about alienation and all that kind of thing, but it's just a very appealing. It appeals to me. So I don't know why I kind of just picked it up, you know, as kind of, you know, I quite enjoy his music as well, but this is a great film. And but for my actual PhD, two of the films that I've looked at, I'm always open as well to, you know, kind of new ideas, but that XXY and Tomboy. Mm. And there's often a particular pace to the kinds of films that, that personally appeal to me. And I would say this has got that similar kind of quite linear sort of... I don't know, do you know the film? You kind
no,
of,
I haven't seen this.
It's pretty cool, actually. It's from the 1970s, and it's sort of quite fragmented, and it's based on a novel as well, I think. And you might think, well, it's the rock star in a film, it's going to not be so great. But it seems to have been perfect for David Bowie at that particular point in his career, and he plays that part really well. Maybe it wasn't too much of a stretch, because he was playing this kind of alien-type figure anyway, I suppose. Mm. So it wasn't too much of a stretch, but it's interesting to look at it now. And I've even started to think, we were talking about the idea of the invisibility of whiteness, you know. Mm. And this film started to make me think then, it is this alien character. He's an alien, but more of an Englishman in some ways, you know, in America, you know, in some small town America. So he's obviously been between all kinds of things, as well as being from a completely different planet, is the thing. But it made me think as well of the idea of this kind of, you know, he's still a white man, you know, within this setting, even though he's an alien. And it just made me think of the different kind of cultural sides as well to this kind of, you could watch it from the perspective of thinking about white masculinity, you know, if you wanted to think about it in that kind of way, I think, as well. Different kinds of power structures and homosocial kind of bonding and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot. I think there's all sorts, as well as just being an enjoyable film that you can just watch and, you know, just enjoy the visuals. And so that's it. You know, that's my little.
This is your collage.
This is my little kind of selection of bits. Great. And pieces. And
should we take a picture of it?
Yes. Okay. I'll that like that. I don't know how you want
it. I think
it.
We've missed out on the daylight for.
Oh, right.
For the lovely pictures in the sun. The lighting is a bit weird in here.
Oh, good. See if they come.
But I can send these to you.
Oh, they look. They're not too bad.
For yourself to have.
They're not too bad at all, actually. Yeah. I mean, if you want to take another, if I can, I don't know if I can position them in a. I suppose you want to kind of see.
Maybe.
It's a better camera than mine, anyway. Always have problems with cameras. Yeah, yeah, that should be quite good.
We can stop this.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realise that was on.
Hesitate taking pictures of you in this lighting, because I know it just won't turn out very well.
You don't
so
mind.
If there's another time, maybe.
Okay, all right.
With better daylight, maybe we can get some pictures.